Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking workers, we are talking employment, we are talking, how do we call it, Martin? Fair wage for a fair day's work, is that right?
Fair day's pay for a fair day's work, Tony. Nothing changes in 100 years.
Speaking of that, lads, this podcast is free. It is free. We give it away, but that does not mean that it does not have value. We rely on listeners to help us out. So if you could go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, the price of a cup of coffee keeps us going. Anyway, look, plugs aside, delighted to be joined by returning TD for Labour Party's Jed Nash. Jed, thank you so much for joining us. And we are joined by lecturer in NUI Galway, Owen Daly. Owen, happy first time on the podcast. Good to see you both on this new Zoom reality that we all live in.
Thanks for having me on.
No, listen, I can't but think, actually, I wanted to start somewhere else, but events, as they say, events. We read the rhetoric that came out this morning, Jed, of the us versus them narrative from the Now Tánaiste about public service versus private. I'd like to get your reaction on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, I look, it's this old trope. We've heard enough of this over the years, separating one group of workers from another. It's divisive. It's deliberate, in my view, as well. And remember, the Tánaiste may be creating the conditions for the narrative around potential successor to the current public sector pay deal. A commitment has been made by the government, the new government, to honour the public sector pay deal, as you would expect, the one that's in place at the moment. And there's an additional 2% due for public sector workers across the board in October. There's been some kind of discourse around that about whether or not that should be paid. Of course it should be paid. You would expect the state to honour an agreement that it's made with its own workers. And remember, Tony, we're talking here about the doctors and nurses on whom we've depended so heavily over the last few months in particular. The hospital porters, the healthcare assistants, the hospital chefs, security staff, lab staff, home helps employed by the HSE who have done extraordinary work putting themselves in harm's way over the last few weeks and months to make sure that the most vulnerable people in our society are cared for. So that's what we're talking about here. So any kind of narrative that, you know, pits public and private sector workers against one another is not the direction of travel we need to be going in, to be frank. And this is, I think, a kind of typical narrative that we would expect from a lot of hardcore Fine Gaelers, to be honest. We had the same experience ourselves during our spell in government. Lots of fairly well-heeled Fine Gael TDs dissing the public service, not taking it seriously, not valuing it properly, and trying to create that sort of tension between private and public sector, which just is not on, to be perfectly frank. All workers are important. All workers should be valued through pay policy and their terms and conditions. And now certainly is not the time. Never is a time, but now certainly isn't a time to turn our backs on the public sector workers we all depend on.
I think, Tony, it's the Venezuela effect, where, you know, we look at the worst and we say, why aren't all workers in this precariat? Why are public sector workers got a decent pension, a standard of living? And it's not, you know, in comparison to other countries, it's not fabulous. But we should be bringing public sector workers up to that bar, not dragging, private sector workers up to that bar, not dragging public sector workers down into the gutter. I mean, we should aim for the stars, not for the gutter. Absolutely.
My only thing is I'll go with the idea. Here's my problem. More than 10 years since the global financial crisis, we were told that austerity was the medicine. And this is a statement, not a question. We were told that austerity was the medicine, but we know what changed. We changed events. The changed events was the ECB stepping up saying they will do whatever it takes to save the euro. And it did. It became the bond buyer, it became the quantitative easing, it became all of these things. And now we're being told to accept that we will need austerity by another name or whatever it is. And I just don't think pitting, changing the narrative. And I was disappointed again, because I point back to the study that was done by Dr. Aileen Maron, who spoke about the fact that the narrative of framing public versus private as long ago as 2012 was detrimental to the public service itself. And it created stigmas that we don't need. So let's not go back there. Anyway, back to it. Martin.
Yes, Jed. There was a ruling came out of the High Court last week. Now, you were very heavily involved in getting the processes in place. I know you've worked a very long, long time. And it's to do with pay agreements. Will you explain to us exactly what your role in this was? I know you put in a lot of work, and you worked both with the AG and senior politicians to get this across the line. And then we'll ask on what happened and what do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll avoid going into the detailed kind of technical arguments about it. Owen can, I think, articulate that much better than I can, and in easily understood terms as well, because we can get a little bit bogged down on technical legal issues here. I guess what we might do and what I might do at the outset is just explain what sectoral employment orders are and what they sought to achieve. I mean, going back to 1909, a better person than I, Winston Churchill, decided to establish what are known as trade boards. And the trade boards essentially established, they were the forerunners really of the sector employment order system and indeed the joint labour committee system, which is another form of sectoral bargaining in this country that we legislated for back in 2000. So these trade boards were really designed to ensure that there was a space and an institutional kind of framework for employers and trade unions representing sectors of industry that were hard to reach, where there was low trade union density and where workers were open to exploitation and were vulnerable, to come together to agree statutorily enforceable basic minimum terms and conditions in very vulnerable sectors. So we've had a history going back to 1909, in fact, of these kinds of sectoral bargaining systems that really ensured that labour costs were kind of taken out of the equation when it came to employers tendering for business and so on. And actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to read you out a quote from Winston Churchill back in 1908, which really, I think, puts into context the whole principle of trade boards and institutional sectoral bargaining. And if you bear with me for a second, I'll quote the man himself. But where you have what we call sweated trades, you have no organization, no parity of bargaining. The good employer is undercut by the bad. The bad employer is undercut by the worst. The worker whose whole livelihood depends upon the industry is undersold by the worker who only takes the trade up as a second string. His feebleness and ignorance generally renders the worker an easy prey to the tyranny of the masters and the middlemen, only a step higher up the ladder than the worker and held in the same relentless grip of forces. Where those conditions prevail, you have not a condition of progress, but a condition of progressive degeneration. Old style language, but I think those particular principles are still important in this day and age. And we all know how vulnerable workers are to exploitation without the protection of a trade union or the kind of institutional frameworks that sectoral bargaining provide for you. So back in 2012, a case was taken by a group of employers against provisions made in the 1946 Act, which kind of gave effect to this state's kind of idea that, yeah, sectoral bargaining is a public good. It's in the common interest. It's something that we want to see as a kind of badge of, I think, civility in this country and to prevent people from falling into penury and to support as well good employers and good business practice. So the 1946 Act gave effect really to what was known as the Registered Employment Agreement system. Now, anybody who's working in construction would be familiar with these Registered Employment Agreements. They were, for a host of different reasons that Owen might explain, were struck down as unconstitutional by the Superior Courts back in 2012. So I worked really hard for about 2 years to try to reinstitute a framework for sectoral bargaining in this country.
That was after That was after the case was struck down, Jim.
After the case.
After 2012, yeah.
We tried to figure out and understand what this, it's known as the McGowan judgment, told us. Now, it told us, for example, that the principles and policies and procedures that the Labour Court are using to frame these kind of bargaining sort of tools were deficient, and that there was a significant deficiency in terms of RUCTA's oversight. So you had essentially the Labour Court and a group of employers and trade unions making law. And Martin, as you know from your stellar work on bogus self-employment, that there was only one lawmaking body in this country, and that's the Oireachtas.
That's right.
So we looked very closely with the Attorney General, with the trade union movement, and indeed with employer bodies about how you could actually reinstitute these kind of frameworks to support good business practice and to prevent a race to the bottom in terms of labour costs and pay. So we brought in this new system, as we thought, informed by the McGowan judgment on the deficiencies that identified. So now, moving swiftly on to last week's judgment, the particular judge who considered this case was taken by a small group of electrical contractor employers, took the view that this particular system is now invalid, it's not constitutionally kind of robust, and there weren't sufficient kind of, you know, isn't sufficient RUCTA's oversight, and there were failures in terms of the policies and procedures. It's interesting, actually, he used very similar language that McGowan used, McGowan judgment had back in 2012. So there's been a history over the last kind of 10 years in particular, three particular judgments that served to essentially demolish the system of sectoral bargaining that we have had in this country for quite a number of years. There are currently about maybe 200,000 workers covered by these agreements. Sector employment orders are generally reflected as well in someone's contract. So I'm not that concerned about the status of those who are currently covered by the now invalid orders. But I'd be really concerned about, you know, a race to the bottom in the industry if these orders, if there's no stay in these orders and if we don't resurrect them. I think the legislation myself is amenable to amendment to make it more constitutionally secure. But that's something I think we might hear from Owen on.
Yeah, Owen, I was just going to come in there and say, Owen, will you explain to us exactly what happened in the ruling?
Yeah, Jed's given a good overview there. Basically, from the constitutional point of view, and bear in mind that there's more than constitutional law involved in the judgments. There's procedural issues as well to do with the way in which the Labour Court made the decision. But from the constitutional point of view, the problem is that the Industrial Relations Act, the Amendment Act, gave to a body other than the Oireachtas itself the power to make law. Because these wage regulations are a form of law, effectively, because they're enforced. Or apparently they weren't very well enforced. But, you know, in principle, they create sanctions and so on. So they're a form of lawmaking power. And this is a huge constitutional problem generally, who can be given the power to make law. And it is true on the one hand to say that the Oireachtas is, according to Article 15, the Oireachtas is the sole and exclusive lawmaking power for the state. Okay, but the reality is that it's not very practical for only the Oireachtas to make laws because of the cumbersome nature of the parliamentary process. It's a lot more convenient in practice for the Oireachtas to be able to delegate that power to others. That tends to be ministers, usually. It's not necessarily ministers. It tends to be, it could be regulatory bodies of some kind. It's local authorities, too, have lawmaking power. And the general principle is that all lawmaking power flows through the Oireachtas. The Oireachtas doesn't have to wield it itself, but it can delegate it downwards to other agencies or entities in the state. Okay, so that's it's inevitable. It happens in all modern countries that the parliament has to allow other agencies to deal with at least the minutiae of the law. So the courts have had to strike some kind of compromise over decades. They have to let the Oireachtas delegate some of its lawmaking powers because the state simply couldn't work otherwise. But they have to uphold the primacy of the Oireachtas as the so-called sole and exclusive legislature for the state. So the compromise that courts arrived at a long time ago, or where they drew the line, was to say that the Oireachtas can delegate lawmaking powers via an act. It can pass an act delegating powers to somebody else, as long as the subordinate body is only given the power to legislate for matters of detail. Okay? And the principles and policies of legislation, according to the court, must be contained in the original act of the Oireachtas itself. The idea here is that you can give to a minister or somebody else, say the Labour Court, the power to flesh out the details of the law, or to make subordinate or secondary legislation, as long as the Oireachtas remains the primary legislature. Now, that's all very vague. What that actually means in practice is very open to interpretation. So that's the problem. Okay. Something to make this simpler, a very good example to make this simpler is the example of drugs legislation. And this came up in a separate case a few years ago, the Bedarov case. It was a Russian man who was prosecuted in Blanchardstown for possession of methylethcathinone. And methylethcathinone had been banned by a government order. The thing is that the Misuse of Drugs Act, enacted the Oireachtas in 1979, it banned certain drugs listed in the index to the schedule to the act, but it gave to the government, delegated to the government, a power to ban further drugs not specified in the act itself. And this is a typical example of delegated legislation, because the reason they do this is that the Oireachtas can't necessarily foresee all the drugs they might need to ban because of pharmaceutical innovations. So they delegate to somebody else, in this case the government, the cabinet, the power to legislate in a more expedient way as new circumstances arise. That has advantages of speed and convenience, but it has the disadvantage of bypassing parliamentary process. Okay? So whatever you think of banning drugs, it's a kind of a handy device through which some subordinate entity can make laws in fast-changing circumstances without having to resort to an act of the Oireachtas every time. Do I have you all still?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bedarov actually challenged his conviction, his prosecution, because he argued that the Misuse of Drugs Act was an excessive delegation of legislative power from the Oireachtas to somebody else, in this case, the government. And it was an extremely complicated case. There were three separate rulings, which is quite unusual, from the High Court, the Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court. They are the three levels of court that can rule on constitutional issues. And he lost in the High Court, won in this Court of Appeal, and lost again, ultimately, in the Supreme Court. The real debate was whether the legislation, the act of whether the original, what we call the Parent Act, the primary legislation, whether it gave the subordinate body, the government, whether it gave the body being delegated power, whether it gave it too much leeway, too much discretion to legislate of its own accord. And Bedarov's argument was that the original act didn't contain any guidelines, any principles based on which the government would use this power. So his argument was that the government could ban anything. Any substance or preparation, in theory, it could ban caffeine or alcohol or tobacco or whatever.
They could add anything to the list as they saw fit.
Yeah, that was his argument, that there was effectively the government or a subordinate body, not the Oireachtas itself, was being given carte blanche to legislate on whim. And he won on that argument in the Court of Appeal, but he lost in the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court ultimately decided that for there to be principles in the policies in the original act doesn't actually require an awful lot. The long title to that act, the Misuse of Drugs Act, referred to dangerous and harmful drugs. And the Supreme Court said that's actually enough. They are actually criteria or principles which, in theory at least, will limit and guide the subordinate body in how it actually goes about exercising this power. So, for example, if the government tried to ban something innocuous, like, I don't know, say caffeine, if that is innocuous, then you could at least challenge that in the courts because it had gone beyond the powers given by the Act. Okay? Mm-hmm. So basically, the general tendency has been for the Supreme Court to apply this body of constitutional doctrine in a very lenient way, which in practice allows the Oireachtas to delegate an awful lot of legislative powers to other bodies, which tend to be ministers in practice. And, for example, in the area of immigration, the Minister for Justice historically has been given an awful lot of leeway to make statutory instruments around things like deportations and so on. And that's all been upheld because all that's required is that the minister isn't just given carte blanche by the Oireachtas to do as he or she wants. Now, the thing is, and I'm getting to the point ultimately, there has been that lenient approach applied by the Supreme Court over the decades, except for industrial relations. So it has, over the past decade, ever since the John Gray's Fried Chicken case. Now, the John Gray's Fried Chicken was a restaurant in, maybe still is a restaurant in Cork City Centre.
Well, it's called something else now. I think
I don't know. Look, so it's a fried chicken restaurant, and they took a case back in 2011, 2012 against the Joint Labour Committees, which had the power to effectively legislate for a negotiated sector-specific minimum wage. And the Supreme Court legal scholars might disagree about this, but in my view, basically, I don't want to say massaged, but it distinguished all of the earlier precedents and imposed a much stricter view of what delegated legislation requires. Okay, the fact that their concern was that the JLCs, the Joint Labour Committees, that they were at large, as it put it, in how they calculated or determined the sector-specific minimum wage, which was then to become law. And there were no principles or guidance contained in the original legislation which would guide them or constrain them in doing this. Now, to my mind, this was completely unrealistic. It was a very abstract kind of thing to say because, obviously, anything done by negotiation in that way through a joint labour committee with representatives from unions and employers, it isn't going to do anything wild or do anything extreme because it's negotiation. You know, it's not like you have a single person who can make up a figure on a whim, which was the way the Supreme Court portrayed it. Obviously, there are constraints on that process. The constraints are the bargaining constraints, the difficulty in actually reaching an agreement, rather. But nonetheless, the court said that if you were to delegate to some subordinate body the power to legally set wages or minimum wages, the legislation that gives that power would have to contain guidelines or principles that would constrain or guide that body in doing so. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And, you know, what was assumed after that case and a very similar case that Jed referred to called the McGowan case was that all we needed really were quite general principles that were very much open to interpretation because of the fact that in earlier cases like the Bedaroff case, the Oireachtas had gotten away with using very generic, vague terminologies in the original legislation, such as dangerous drugs or harmful drugs, and that was enough to satisfy the constitutional requirement of not handing over lawmaking power carte blanche. Okay? Now, the reason why Jed and others assumed that the legislation struck down last week in the High Court, the Amendments Act of 2015, which tried to fill that gap left by the earlier cases, was that this new legislation did contain principles which were to guide the Labour Court in the recommendation it made to the Minister to set a sector-specific minimum wage. And the main guidelines, I don't have the text of the Act before me, but so I hope I'm misrepresenting this, but the main principles contained in the 2015 Act were fair remuneration and harmonious industrial relations. That's a fair summary of the relevant section, Jed, isn't it?
We just lost Jed there for a minute, but yes, that is. I've read it myself. That is a good summary of the relevant sections.
So basically, fair wages and ensuring industrial harmony were the principles that were supposed to guide the Labour Court in the way in which it used this power to set, or to indirectly set at least, a sector-specific minimum wage. And to my mind, this should have been completely above board, because if you look at all the earlier case law, the Supreme Court and other courts have always emphasized the importance of the Oireachtas having to leave some leeway, some discretion to the subordinate lawmakers, such as the ministers, to make some kind of judgment of their own and to not constrain them with excessive rules or excessive legislative criteria, because that's the reality of administration. You can't pin everything down to legislative rules. Sometimes you have to make a judgment that's based on experience or expertise or realpolitik or whatever, and that's often, in fact, a very in social democratic or socialist governmental systems, that kind of administrative or bureaucratic discretion becomes very important, because insofar as the mission of the state is to elevate living standards and to regulate economy and society, you have to give powers, you have to give legal powers to the administration to intervene and to do things without being excessively tied down by the either the parliament or the courts. Yes, you have to have some oversight, but you have to actually empower the state administration to do these things. Okay, and that's why it was a surprise to me that the High Court last week struck down the 2015 Amendment Act. It said that if the Oireachtas were to take the view that it was justifiable or necessary to limit market competition or wage market competition for the sake of fairness or for the sake of whatever, the Oireachtas would have to explicitly mandate that in the original primary legislation itself. And it basically said that the criteria contained in the 2015 Amendment Act were too vague and they weren't sufficiently specific to satisfy that constitutional requirement I've been talking about.
Yeah.
And now I feel like I've given a lecture. Yeah.
No, we that's it's very important. Like our listeners tend to want to get the structure of this. So with that decision, and maybe we go to Jed on this, where does this leave us now then with that being the case?
Yeah, I'm sorry, my line was a little unstable.
No, you're okay.
Catch everything that Owen had said. And I know as well, of course, that your listeners and your viewers are very discerning. It's a discerning audience, and I think it's really useful and important that Owen provides that sort of framework.
Absolutely.
For
brilliant.
This issue, because this detail is important and the history of it is important as well. I said in my earlier contribution, we've had now three challenges to sectoral bargaining mechanisms, well-established sectoral bargaining mechanisms, by employer bodies over the last 10 years, and quite a lot of what I might describe as judicial activism in the area, compared, for example, to the lack of concern, it would seem, around competition and around property rights and so on. And I think that's a feature as well of our relatively weak kind of institutional framework in relation to the whole sort of principle of collective bargaining in this country. Another feature of the 2015 Industrial Relations Act, Chapter 3 of which was struck down by the High Court last week relating to SEOs, is the question of collective bargaining. And we've gone as far as the AG had advised us at that time, as far as we possibly could constitutionally, in terms of providing for a new framework for collective bargaining in this country in that 2015 Act. So there is a kind of wider question about the capacity for the Oireachtas to legislate to allow for that framework to be enhanced and improved in the interests of working people in this country. And we know that the countries that do best economically and socially are those countries that have strong, robust collective bargaining frameworks, the likes of Germany, the likes of France, the likes of Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and so on, where there is that strong social democratic tradition. So in many ways, we're up against it. There's no doubt about it. The steps that we need to take now, I think, are several. The first thing that needs to happen is that the Minister for Business, Enterprise and Innovation, Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, needs to make it very clear to his department officials that, as a matter of public interest, this judgment needs to be appealed to the Supreme Court urgently, because this is a very serious question of public interest that needs to be settled by the Supreme Court. There needs, I think, a stay to be placed on the order to make sure that the terms and conditions that would have been provided for in the three orders that have now been essentially deemed to be invalid because the law has been struck down, that they need to remain in place to provide certainty as well for employers in the sector. Because remember, this isn't just about providing for minimum enhanced pay rates below the statutory or above the statutory minimum and things like sick pay schemes, statutory sick pay schemes and pension schemes for workers. But it's actually also as well about promoting harmonious industrial relations. And that was a key feature of the legislation that I had drafted and marshalled through the Oireachtas in 2015.
Does that hurt the Industrial Relations Act of 1990, though, Jed? Should that be that no longer fit for purpose?
Well, that's another question. I think a very live debate, which I'd be only too happy to revisit, because that does indeed put certain restraints on workers. There's no doubt about that. And I think I recall 1990 that was introduced, I think, by Bertie Ahern
when
he was Minister for Labour. In fact, what we need actually is another standalone. We need to revisit that, a standalone Department of Labour, to make sure that the interests of working people are balanced.
I would argue that a Minister for Jobs may cover that area, Jed.
Well, it should, you would think. But I mean, the reality is, since the Employment Affairs, and it's actually interesting now that the Employment Affairs section of the old Department of Jobs is now going back in to the Department of Business. And I think we've kind of missed that. I was never gone on the idea that Employment Affairs should necessarily be in the Department of Social Protection, because my fear was that the Department of Business would just become the downtown office of IBEC. And you wouldn't have that balance that you would have had in recent years in terms of the competing interests of labour and capital, without sounding too highfalutin about it. And that has an impact on policy development and an impact on legislation for obvious reasons. You need that balance. So look, what we need to do now is have this appeal to the Supreme Court, put a stay on the order to make sure the terms and conditions still apply to everybody without question, particularly for new entrants into the sector. I mean, if you're looking at the construction sector employment order, that is no longer kind of extant. It's now what we might describe as a purported order. That provides for wage rates, for example, of the most recent construction SCO that was signed, I think it was in October of 2019, pay rates of basic minimum €19.96. for construction craft workers. That's a basic statutory minimum. Most employers are paying more because it's a competitive market and they pay for your skills. There's no doubt about it. Our fear, of course, now is that the only piece of wage legislation that is enforceable at the moment is the National Minimum Wage Act. The order signed by the minister last year to give effect to the Low Pay Commission's recommendation, the commission I set up, which provides for a statutory minimum rate of pay of no less than €10.10 an hour. So some employers would argue that, well, I'm only going to pay my electrician or my bricky or my pipe fitter €10.10 an hour now, and that's a concern. By the way, as well, and I said this to you, Martin, on the phone last week when we discussed this issue, I've been in contact with a lot of good employers around this country over the last week who have their head in their hands now saying, look, I don't want to have to compete for tenders
to the bottom.
And get involved in that race to the bottom with a dodgy contractor who, if you're lucky, will pay his staff €10.10 an hour. I want to pay my staff a good rate of pay. I've been contacted by good agencies, for example, who are working in the construction sector, mm-hmm. who operate best practice and say, look, the first thing we do actually when we engage with an employer, say a new piece of business for them, is do you pay the SEO rate? Are you compliant with the Health Safety Act 2005? You know, all of these things. Are you tax compliant? And their view is we don't take on a client if they're not. So they want to promote the idea of best practice. They want to promote industrial harmony. And remember, if a construction worker or a trade union operating in the sector
decides that they want to they want to challenge something, or want, you know, if there's a bit of industrial unrest, we'll say, in the sector, then under the SEO, the first manner in which they address that issue is actually on the shop floor, with the employer body, and there's a dispute resolution procedure that's actually central to the sector employment order. So it does promote the idea of industrial harmony, and that is one of the principles and sort of procedures that's very clear in the Act itself, and the idea as well that when you're resolving these issues and when you're looking at the potential for a sectoral employment order that's implementable and enforceable across the sector, that you must have due regard to competition, to competitiveness, to affordability, and all of these key kind of considerations.
Jed, can I come in?
As if the Act is actually without policies and procedures. The view of the judge is that the policies and procedures and principles weren't strict enough.
Now, I'm going to take just, Martin, you can come in. I know you have a question for Jed, but I actually, just while I have Owen on the line, it's important that I very cheekily use this digression, because all of this strikes me as you're talking about the constitutional, the rights. One of the things that we're very passionate about here is the right to housing, and the fact that it's protected in international law. The UN has a right to housing and a right to adequate housing. And we're continuously told that the right to property is in our constitution, but there is no right to housing. Can't, in your mind's eye, and that you know, feel free to tell me, Tony, this is not what I came on here for. A right like that, can it be legislated for, or do we need to have a right to housing in the constitution to offset the right to property?
Yeah, I mean, you can totally create rights to housing. Like there are rights. There are plenty of countries that have legal rights to housing. I'm agnostic about the value of putting it in a constitution. I'm certainly not against it, but there's one note of caution. Just is that I would fear it's actually a distraction, and that it's not a good strategy. It's not the principle of it. I'm just not sure it's good political strategy. Because we've had examples of people using a constitution to try to achieve political ends, and it ends up not being a very good tool for doing that. Because people have this tendency, I suppose, to want to use some kind of legal instruments to supersede politics and political struggle and so on. And it's not that it doesn't have a role, but it just may, you know, there's always the risk that it's counterproductive. So if you look at something like the children's referendum, you know, the idea that we would improve children's rights by constitutionally enshrining them. It's actually difficult to achieve things like that by adopting a constitutional amendment. There's lots of complex reasons behind that. It's partly enforcement. It's partly that it's difficult to enshrine a principle or a goal or an aim or in a constitution and then hope for the best in terms of the courts actually bringing that about, or forcing the government to do that. For example, can they force the government to commit the resources? Will they specify what resources are needed? How will they actually hold the government to account in doing that? What's the sanction? So, you know, it's there can be an element of wishful thinking. So we had the children's rights referendum in, what was it, 2012, I think. It passed. I had nothing against it. It did some good things. It changed the law in some good ways. But then we ended up with a huge spike in child homelessness. We ended up with austerity damaging children's rights in the real sense in many ways. So if we were to be serious about housing, we would, of course, be committing resources to public housing. We would probably have a Housing Act, an act of the Oireachtas defining rights to housing, which would have sufficient detail, and it could be easily amended and all this. I'm not sure a campaign to have a referendum to put it in the constitution would actually achieve an awful lot more, and it could be counterproductive because, you know, there's a temptation to invest an awful lot in that symbolism of having the amendments, and now we've done this, we've stated this. For example, we have expressed our commitment to children's rights. And by its nature, that drains some political capital away or some political energy away. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I do. It strikes me as, like, when I think about it in terms of if you Ireland's position around the international UN protections for people with disabilities, where we finally were late to sign up the protocol, and then we opted out of the optional protocol so far as, like, yes, we have this, we've enacted it, and then they went, oh, by the way, if you can't attest that right, you can't actually come after us as well. So there's a similar, just my fear as obviously it's something, you've mentioned two things I'm passionate about. One, drug decriminalization and making a harm reduction model, and two, the housing section. So I don't believe either that the constitution is the place for all of these things. I think we should be able to legislate for them, but I just want to know, while I have you on the line, you know, the place?
The constitution is more likely to be a barrier, an obstacle, than to be, you know, this positive instrument that the left has, to be honest. There's no reason in principle why you can't use or instrumentalize a constitution for left-wing ends. So that there's a South African Bill of Rights, which has rights to housing and healthcare, and are kind of enforced in a way. At least there's a responsibility on governments to adopt progressive realization, it's called, of those rights, subject to resources and so on. But if you look at the broad sweep of constitutional history in the Western countries, at least, more often than not, constitutional law has been a hindrance towards what you might call state activism or state intervention in economic and social life. So a colleague or a friend of mine tweeted a link to this case last week and says, is this an Irish Lochner moment? Now, Lochner was an infamous case in the early 20th century in the United States. There was a series of cases in which the Supreme Court, on the most tenuous textual basis in the Constitution itself, struck down a range of acts in the US which regulated employment and economic activities, particularly things like the maximum working hours or even wage regulation. They were struck down because freedom of contract, as it's called, was understood as being a protected constitutional right. So when we talk about constitutional rights, people think that's that's necessarily a good thing, but it's actually not. It's not always a good thing to say that a right is protected. You must, sometimes that's just ideology. Sometimes that's just verbiage. A constitutional right only means an interest which somebody thinks is sufficiently important to warrant the terminology of right. So, you can say that there's, billionaires have a right to their reputation so that they can't be, they can't be held to account sufficiently in the media. There are obviously property rights which protect landlords. And you also have, this old right, which was eventually superseded by the New Deal and the post-war welfare states, the right to so-called freedom of contract, which literally means the freedom of the employer and employee to agree a wage without interference. It's portrayed as an act of freedom on both sides of the contract because there is, in theory, there is consent or agreement on both sides with no interference from an outside party. And of course, we all know that that's nonsense because of the fact that you have unequal bargaining power. But the liberal perspective, I suppose, the classical liberal perspective at least, emphasizes the importance of consent, the importance of formal surface consent or agreement, and the importance of keeping the state at arm's length. And that's the perspective which was historically emphasized by courts and judges. And that ideology was pushed back over the 20th century, but there, it's still present in some ways. And if you read the judgment from last week, there are elements of that are evident in it. The judgment refers to freedom of contract. It refers to the importance of the Oireachtas having sufficient justification for allowing a state body to interfere with that private market relationship. Okay, so that's what constitutional law has tended to do historically. It has tended to be a boundary against, a barrier, an obstacle against state intervention in and state regulation of economic and social relationships. And sorry, go ahead. I
was just going to come in there, Owen, and I'm going to bring us back. And I understand what you're saying about the contract, but there is an element of coercive power within that as well, in that one person holds all of the cards. Jed, we've seen this in construction, and basically now is a very, very precarious time for construction. And basically the door is open to every cowboy to come in and undercut, as you said, decent employers. It's reckless in a construction point of view. Owen, where does it go? Is this going to go to the Supreme Court? Is there any guarantee that there will be another look at it? Or are we just stuck here now until the Oireachtas has some sort of legislative process that will stand up in court?
Well, the thing is, I must emphasize, the judge didn't say that the Oireachtas can't have this kind of legislative framework by which it delegates to the Labour Court or a minister the power to set wages or regulate wages. It doesn't say that. In theory, all it says is that the Oireachtas must set down more specific criteria under which that is done. But if you read further, the judgment makes it very difficult to envisage exactly what kind of legislation might successfully achieve that. And my fear is that this line of case law, if it's upheld, will keep grinding down the scope of possibility for industrial relations legislation, and that it might be a kind of the thin end of a wedge for a medium to longer term liberalisation of the whole area. Okay, which is...
Is there a conflict between Oireachtas and judiciary on this? Is there a smudging of the lines of where powers lie?
Well, there's no doubt but that the courts from the High Court up have the power to overturn legislation that's unconstitutional. But the courts have also always said that they must give the Oireachtas some kind of room for manoeuvre, that they only strike down legislation as a last resort, that the initial power to make that judgment as to what good law is a matter for the Oireachtas, and that they only police the outer boundaries of what is permissible. Okay, so the Irish courts have always said that we are not politically activist, we don't want to interfere in policy, but that tends to be very uneven, obviously. So whenever the courts have been called upon to recognize things like social rights or economic rights or to apply them into the Constitution, they have always declined to do so based on a concern for respecting that boundary between the legal sphere and the political sphere. But that can be a little bit inconsistent, to be honest. And this is the kind of judicial intervention which has this potential to be massively significant in transforming industrial relations. So there's nothing illegitimate about it from that, you know, from that technical legal point of view. But as an instance of judicial intervention in industrial relations, it has potentially huge importance. This is bearing in mind that the Irish courts are generally speaking quite reserved. For the last couple of decades, they don't tend to push the boat out and to strike down laws willy nilly. They tend to practice a doctrine of deference, in other words, deferring to the judgment of the political branches of the state. So that's why this is a little bit specific. It's a little bit anomalous in a sense, in that it is really, you know, it's potentially transformative, and in a way that is, well, in my view, is not wise and is not very promising for industrial relations.
So what's the call, Jed?
Yeah, I mean, look, Owen is dead right, and this has been my concern from day one. This judgment could end up having wider implications for those of us who are in the Oireachtas, duly elected, with a vision for transforming the rights of working people. And where you start with that is around pay and legislating for better terms and conditions as a kind of basic sort of social minimum, a basic social floor beneath which nobody should be allowed to fall. And this has implications undoubtedly for the capacity of the Oireachtas to legislate into the future. That's my concern. I'm also concerned as well, Tony, that given what has been said around essentially outsourcing, I've used that term, the power to legislate and make laws, it could, for example, mean that next up for shaving and the next piece of legislation that would be vulnerable would be the legislation that governs the joint labour committee sector. We've active joint labour committees and employment regulation orders that have given effect to JLC recommendations in contract cleaning and in security, to very vulnerable sectors open to exploitation. And you could even go further and say, well, you know, is the National Minimum Wage Act and the legislation giving effect to the Low Pay Commission, for example, vulnerable as well to challenge? I don't want to invite that challenge, but I think that's a discussion we need to have in the political system. And if those kinds of pieces of legislation fall, you know, it has huge implications for income inequality in this country and our ambitions to address that, because the most searing form of inequality anybody can experience is economic in nature, in my view. That determines who you are, where you live, and your prospects in life. And it's why I went into public life in the first place, why I put my name in the ballot paper many, many years ago, is to try to transform the experience of working people in this country and try to make this country a little bit more equal than it is. And we need the capacity to legislate to do that. So there are all these really important questions that need to be addressed. And I think that this particular case needs to be reviewed and examined by the Supreme Court. We've proposed as well just a practical solution to this. We drafted a bill last week that could address some of the defects that the High Court have identified around secondary legislation. What we could do, for example, is take the three orders that had been in existence and essentially transform them into primary law, primary kind of acts of the Oireachtas. We proposed that to government last week. It's something we in the Labour Party want to do to try to, I guess, take a kind of bit of a belt and braces approach to restore the status and confirm the status of those old orders, to give some reassurance to good employers in those sectors and workers that their interests are being protected until such time as this issue is more comprehensively resolved and definitively resolved.
Thank you very much for taking the time to explain this, Jed and Owen. Thank you very, very much. That was a great insight into the background to this. Hopefully, a Supreme Court hearing will go ahead, but there's no guarantees of that. There are no plans in the pipeline for that yet. But thank you so much for coming on and explaining the situation. And we can only keep our fingers crossed that there is some breakthrough somewhere and that it is not the start of the race to the bottom, or no, I won't say the start, the continuation of the race to the bottom. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Tony. Thank you. Thank you.
Tony, your mic is off there, buddy.
We do need listeners to give us a hand. We just do. It's as simple as that. We need you to come on. We need you to help us. Go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We're laughing here. We're talking about a fair wage for a fair day's work, Martin.
Yeah, I know. And it's something that I fight for a lot, Tony.
I know. And here you are sitting here working for free.
I know.
We need our heads examined after.
Some work has more value than monetary, Tony.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I think it's important that we continue to have these conversations. But if you get something out of them, give something back. It's as easy as that. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's $6. I mean, like, you won't even get a pint for it these days. Talk to you all soon. Take care.